Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. I was at the beach this summer and I went out for an early morning swim, which is one of my favorite things to do. There was a guy in the water on a surfboard just sort of charging ahead into the waves and I said, "Hey, how are you?" Just sort of being polite, right? And he looked at me with this big smile on his face and he said, "I'm just so happy right now." And I said, "Yeah, me too." This is not the kind of thing strangers say to each other usually, but in the context of the year 2020 and the pandemic, expressing exuberance in this little moment of beautiful freedom and joy, it made perfect sense. The pandemic has made a lot of us rethink how we understand or experience happiness. So often, we think of happiness in terms of a big picture life goal, right? With every important decision we make in life, we wonder, will this make me happy? Ending or beginning a relationship, switching careers, starting a family or deciding not to, moving across the country or staying put. But during these recent months, when our lives have been shaped by loss, by restrictions and limitations, many of us have had to re-examine what happiness means and how we can find it. So on today's episode, we wanted to talk to different psychologists who study happiness and hear what they have to say about its role in our lives and what it means now. Up first, what is happiness? Psychologist Sonia Lubomirsky from the University of California, Riverside, says happiness is both a state, as in a fleeting moment that may only last for a few minutes, and it's also a trait, something that's more stable and more present in some people than in others. She says when researchers study happiness, they mostly agree that it involves two main components. The first is that a person frequently experiences positive emotions like
joy, enthusiasm, pride, tranquility, curiosity, affection.
And the other thing is
having a sense that your life is good, that you're progressing towards your life goals, that you're satisfied with your life. So the way I like to think about the two components of happiness is it's what's important is being happy in your life and being happy with your life.
Sonia is interested in whether or not a person can improve how much happiness they experience, especially for the long term.
So we know we can pretty easily make someone happier in the short term for half an hour, for a day. But how do we make people happier for, you know, weeks, months, or years? That's really the biggest challenge.
And where do we get our happiness from? Where does it come from?
I like to think of sort of several kind of buckets of factors that influence happiness. And the first bucket is genetics, right? So we all know that there are genetic influences on happiness, just like the genetic influences on weight or blood pressure or pretty much any human trait. And some people are just born kind of with a range of happiness that's higher than others. The other bucket kind of factors that influence happiness, I would call life circumstances. So how much money you make, what your health is like, whether you're married, where you live. And then the third bucket has to do with sort of the things that you do and how you think and how you behave in your daily life. So these are the things that we can control over our happiness.
And it may be surprising to people that the life circumstances are not that important among those three, right?
Well, actually, life circumstances can be very important. It depends on what they are. So if you live in poverty or if you live in a war zone in Syria or if you are in an abusive relationship, then those circumstances absolutely will influence your happiness a great deal. But if your life circumstances are fairly comfortable and if your basic needs for food, for safety, for shelter are met, then improving those circumstances isn't going to improve your happiness a huge amount, although it probably will improve it somewhat. So it really depends. If your circumstances are already good, then kind of improving them is not going to make a huge difference. But if they're bad, that improving your life circumstances is going to make an absolutely huge difference in your happiness.
Now, if we talk more about the factory setting, so to speak, so the happiness level that comes from our genetics, is that just something we have to learn to live with, or can we alter that? Can we change that over time?
Genetics is very, very complicated. So genes are something that are turned on and off by things in the environment. So it's not like our genes are sort of set in stone and they are kind of the same throughout our lives. So, you know, think about your eye color. So you might have genes that code for you to have brown eyes, but you can put on blue contact lenses. So you can change what your eye color looks like to others. So that's kind of how I think about happiness. So you might be born with a set range for happiness that's lower than you like, but that doesn't mean that how you actually feel day to day is going to be in that low range, because how you feel day to day is going to be influenced by your life circumstances that you can change at least somewhat, and it's going to be influenced by how you think and how you behave in your daily life. So you can actually change your happiness level, even if you can't sort of change what like the genes are programming your set range to be, if that makes sense.
Sonia says certain strategies and behaviors can improve how happy people feel, especially when you do them regularly.
So my lab focuses on especially on two such activities, and one is gratitude and one is kindness. And so we do interventions where we randomly assign people to express gratitude, for example, by writing gratitude letters to people important in their lives or by counting their blessings. And we compare people who do that to various control groups. And we also have done quite a few studies where we ask people to do more acts of kindness in their daily life, like maybe every Monday for the next month, do 3 more acts of kindness that you don't normally do. And it turns out that both of those activities, what they have in common is they make people feel more connected to others, right? So when you write a letter of gratitude to your mom, it makes you feel more connected to her. It might make you, you know, pick up the phone and call her and have lunch with her, and that makes you feel happier. And doing acts of kindness also makes you feel more connected. So we've gotten very interested in whether just sort of doing anything that fosters a sense of connection might make people happier. So we've also done studies where we ask people just to engage in more social interactions, like every week, do 3 more social things that you don't normally do. This is a little more difficult now during the pandemic. Or we did a study where we had really powerful effects, where we simply asked people for a week to act more extroverted, and then for another week to act more introverted, although we didn't actually use those terms. And we found that people who just simply act more social or more assertive or more energetic become happier over time. So those are 3 powerful approaches to becoming a happier person: gratitude and kindness, and also just sort of in general, try to foster connection in your life.
As a happiness researcher, what is your take on the pandemic? I mean, there are new opportunities for us to perhaps discover new things, but there must also be some factors that perhaps have you concerned about everybody's level of happiness.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that feeling connected to others is really what makes life worth living, and hazard to say, is probably the key to happiness. So because we all have had to reduce our in-person social interactions by so much, some studies have said by 95%, that is really challenging for us to sort of maintain a sense of connection.
But for a lot of people, connecting online has become a helpful substitute.
Which is surprising, right? So how can you feel sort of the same level of connection if you can't see your friends and family in person? But of course, what a lot of us have done is, you know, we've sort of tried to replace the face-to-face contact with, you know, Zoom calls and, you know, sort of other ways of connecting. We've also been reaching out to neighbors and sort of friends, teachers, whatever, to help them. So that has also made us feel more connected. And also just kind of being in the same boat, everyone having the same thing to complain about, also makes us feel more of a sense of belonging, a sense of connection. So really, like, anything that we can do to try to kind of maintain that sense of connection, even during these very challenging times, I would say as a happiness researcher, is really critical for us to try to maintain our happiness levels.
Sonia Lubomirsky is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. We're talking about happiness, what it means and how we find it, which is something a lot of us have had to rethink over the last few months.
Well, I mean, I guess we all want to be happy, don't we? And it's one of the central focus in some ways of psychology is how to live well and be happy. I guess I became interested in it because I thought that perhaps sometimes we were going about it the wrong way.
That's Brock Bastian. He is a psychologist at the University of Melbourne in Australia. He's concerned that we are overvaluing happiness.
The idea that to be happy or to try and achieve happiness in life was the ultimate goal. And in that way, I also was, I guess, seeing that that pressure on people to be happy was sometimes producing counterintuitive effects, leading people to actually become less happy as a result of feeling that they needed to, I guess, achieve this emotional goal. You know, in some ways, failing to achieve that level of happiness is somehow, I guess, an additional value is added to that, which is suggesting that we're not being successful in life if we're not feeling happy. You know, happiness is associated with success. And when we feel the negative emotions that we inevitably will feel because we evolve to experience those emotions, they're incredibly useful and incredibly informative. We tend to react to them and feel that they're somehow interrupting our ability to achieve our goal of being happy and staying happy and remaining happy.
In our quest for blissful happiness, where everything is perfect and beautiful, you know, that live, laugh, love moment from Instagram, Brock says we can miss the fact that happiness is more of a byproduct, not the goal in itself, but what we feel when we embrace all of life's challenges.
And I think one of the things we miss is actually the happiest moments in life are often couched in some form of adversity or pain. You know, we often seek out those sorts of experiences because they are the most meaningful and happy experiences. I mean, I often use two examples of that. One would be marathons. You know, people enjoy running marathons. They get a lot of reward and, you know, they feel good. People often sponsor them to run marathons. They get a sense of achievement from that. But of course, if marathons were pain-free, as easy as sitting on your couch at home watching television, that they would be pointless. And no one would train for them. No one would feel a sense of achievement for having done them. And certainly no one would sponsor you to run that marathon. So, you know, we often seek out those sorts of experiences. Another one might be, you know, when you ask people what are the happiest moments of their life, they might say graduating from my course. But of course, graduating from your course means you avoided failure. But if the failure wasn't possible, if it wasn't there in the first place, then graduating wouldn't feel like an achievement. So we step into situations where there either is pain or there's a possibility of pain, broadly speaking, because that's where we actually achieve a lot of happiness in life. And so when we stop to think about it, we're actually, you know, those negative experiences are actually a very important part of producing happiness for us. And in fact, I've made the slightly stronger claim that without those experiences, it would be very hard to achieve any happiness at all.
I asked Brock about some challenges that he faced recently that brought him unexpected happiness. We talked in early September, so Melbourne was just nearing the end of a long and strict quarantine.
I'm living in stage 4 lockdown in Melbourne right now. I think that's a reasonably negative experience.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, it's not all bad. And I suppose again, if I look at that from a perspective of this is terrible, this is horrible, I can't possibly stand it. You know, it would have been a very long 6 weeks. Hopefully, we're coming out in about a week. Whereas if I'm able to sort of see, well, this is a bad experience, but it also offers me the opportunity to spend more time with my family. Even if I can't get away from them ever, but you know, I still get lots of time with them, and I'm seeing a lot of my young boy, and that's nice. And I would take the time to find, you know, to cook some nice meals on the weekend because there's nothing else to do and things like that. So I suppose finding those opportunities in there, and I suppose you also, you know, in those moments, you also work out what you're capable of. If someone had told me in March that I was going to still be in lockdown heading into September, I think I would have just freaked out. But you know what? You know, we've more or less made it. I mean, we did have a little bit of a window of non-lockdown there, but we went back in again. So, you know, I wouldn't have thought I could deal with that. But having come out the other side of it, if someone said, look, you'd have to be locked down for, you know, for 6 to 8 months, I go, well, I've done that before. I guess I could do it again.
So if we are to embrace a more fearless approach to living, what does that look like and where might it take us?
Yeah, well, I think at one level, it's about being able to orient ourselves well to the kinds of challenges, adversities, difficulties that we have to face into, like, you know, like lockdown, for example, like this whole pandemic, like the entire 2020. I believe you've got bushfires over there. We started with bushfires and we ended up with a pandemic. So it's been a horrible year.
Mm-hmm.
Learning to deal well with those sorts of experiences and using the right tools, you know, and it is about learning to step into them. I mean, it's actually pointless to try and run away from these things. They get worse if we try and avoid them or escape them or run away from them. We have to sort of step into them, face up to them and confront them. And when we do that, they actually become a little bit smaller and more manageable. But also, you know, there are lots of opportunities where maybe, you know, we can actually find happiness, but sometimes it's about taking risks, appropriate risks in life. And what we know is that actually, you know, one of the things about depression is that it actually, people stop taking risks and that's actually one of the things that leads to more depression. We do need to take risks in life, appropriate risks and, you know, well-considered ones. But still, things that challenge us, things that throw us into a little bit of discomfort. And it's through that discomfort that we grow, we become stronger. And I guess, as I suggested before, it's often that discomfort and those uncomfortable experiences that we do find, you know, a happiness and also meaning as well. You know, in our own research, when we asked people, you know, to think about the most meaningful events in their lives over the past sort of 6 to 12 months, the most meaningful events were the more emotionally extreme events, whether it be positive or negative. It wasn't the calm events. It wasn't those sort of quiet times. It was actually the times when they were being rocked. So leaning into those and seeking them out a little bit in life may be important and an important way of thinking about how to achieve happiness.
How does all of this figure into your parenting? You have kids, so how do you talk to them about, you know, taking risks, about what is a good life and how we make our days count?
Well, I'm a complete helicopter parent and I protect the woman from all from all risks. Yeah, that's a really funny one. I mean, you know, it's actually quite hard in this culture. I mean, if we let our kids walk to school, we might get frowned at by the parents. And
yeah.
And so, you know, I have 2 10-year-olds. So it's actually quite difficult, and I think as parents, it's actually one of the most challenging things is to step away from that fear of something bad happening to your kids in order to enable them to be able to take those risks. You know, I mean, I hope they go backpacking or something when they're in their sort of, you know, in their later teens and early adult years, which is what I did. But I'm sure, you know, and I know that my mother was just, you know, absolutely petrified of what could happen. But you've kind of got to accommodate that to let your kids take those risks. And if you don't, they don't grow.
Brock Bastian is a psychologist at the University of Melbourne in Australia. He was talking about challenges and risks and how they can lead us to happiness. Our next guest discusses the role of suffering and whether we are hardwired to be happy.
Why do some people have that kind of inner capacity for resilience and joy and some people don't seem to? And what can we do about that?
Psychologist Lise de Geerum had to learn how to cope with suffering at an early age. She was severely burned in an accident as a little girl.
So I was 4 years old, and my family drove up to New Hampshire for a vacation, and it was our first night there. We were outside on the porch of this cabin.
Lisa's mom went to light the grill to make dinner. She was being careless and she used a household solvent instead of lighter fluid. At first, it seemed like the grill hadn't lit, so her mom poured more liquid. But there was a small flame that caused the can of solvent to explode.
So we were instantly engulfed in flame and there was no way off the porch because the flame blocked the exit. And my mother realized this, and she turned her back on me and she ran through the fire and ran down into the lake and saved herself. And I was left there, I was 4 and completely on fire.
Her father and brother had been further away, but her dad ran toward Lise and carried her to the lake to throw her into the water. Lise has no memories of the accident, but her dad described what happened in many letters to other family members and to the insurance company. And what did your mother say about it? She left you there.
My mother never acknowledged that that was a problem. I don't even know how to say it without, it just seems so absurd to me. But my mother, it would never say that she shouldn't have done that or that that was a mistake or that she regretted it. She would only say that anybody under her circumstance would do the same thing.
That she panicked?
That she, anybody under her circumstance would just save themselves.
Lise has written a book about her life and recovery. It's called Flashback Girl, Lessons on Resilience from a Burn Survivor. She says it's a miracle she survived this accident. She had third-degree burns on 65% of her body. Her lower lip was burned away. Her upper arms were fused to her sides. She had at least 40 operations, which were incredibly painful. She had her face rebuilt, skin grafted on the many parts of her body that were burned. She spent most of her childhood in the hospital.
And I was also doing most of that alone. The hospital I went to was about 200 miles away from where we lived, and my parents worked. And so every weekday I was alone in the hospital. They would alternate coming up on the weekends if they could. But it wasn't, honestly, it just wasn't a priority for them to be there, which is, part of my journey too, is to understand who they were and the choices that they made. But I did a lot of this very much as a little girl alone, trying to figure out how to take care of myself the best I could.
Which is unthinkable. I mean, you're a parent, I'm a parent, and the thought of a 4 or 5 year old child doing this incredibly painful treatment by herself is just completely heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly one of the things that happened to me over the course of my life is that things that I just sort of endured as a child or teenager or a young woman and didn't really, sort of like that's the way it was. Once I had kids of my own and I loved them so much and would do anything for them, I was completely focused on, trying to give them a good life and protect them. And all of a sudden I looked back and I thought, wow, that what I went through was so messed up.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you think back to yourself as a child, did you think about happiness? Did you think of yourself as being happy? How did you think about those things?
I think that I dealt with a lot of what I went through by trying to be somewhere else. And I mean by that, I mean, you can be somewhere else in your mind too, right? So I always loved music and I loved, Broadway shows and movies. And so I listened to a lot of music, which brought me somewhere else in my mind. My favorite things, when the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. I was a very imaginative child, so I played a lot of pretend games. Despite the fact that I was just honestly pretty hideous, I've always been good at making friends, so I enjoyed my time with them. I think I just made the best of things, and I don't mean I was even consciously trying to make the best of things. I think that's just what I did.
And do you think you were wired that way, or is that part of the human spirit that we try to make the best of things?
You know, that is, I think, honestly, the question that has propelled me into the work that I do as a psychologist and propelled me into writing the book that I wrote is this question of why do some people have that kind of inner capacity for resilience and joy and some people don't seem to? And what can we do about that? I think for me, yeah, there's a part of me, I am wired this way. I'm a cheerful person, and cheerful people tend to attract more love and support, and then that makes you even more cheerful, you know? So I think there is a certain degree of just that is how I was wired, and I think there's a certain degree of that's how I learned to cope.
And I'm wondering, you were so little when this happened to you, so little that perhaps you hadn't quite yet formed an idea of what life is supposed to be, or what's fair and what's not fair, and you didn't have a fully formed idea of what you were hoping for your life to be. And I wonder if in some way that made it easier to get through.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I didn't have a set of expectations that then I felt were taken away or denied me. And I think also, how do I say this? Sometimes I think it is actually helpful to have gone through terrible things, not just for me, other people too, you know, that people who have gone through terrible things, sometimes then you have a perspective of, oh, look, it's a normal day, you know, and nothing bad is happening. And, oh, look, the sun is out. And, oh, how nice that somebody wrote me this email. And things that other people might, I don't know, expect or think they're just entitled to. If you've suffered a lot, maybe you're more grateful for those little things than people who haven't suffered a lot.
In your life, do you think you made a conscious choice to pursue joy, to pursue happiness, or was it just what you were doing? You were a survivor, you were fighting all these terrible odds, and you just kept going.
Could it be a little bit of both, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes I, and many more than just sometimes, I was just putting one foot in front of the other, just trying to keep going to the next day. And then when I had a little bit more of a sense of relief or not struggling so much, there'd be a sense of, okay, like, I'm here, you know, what can I do with this?
Lise Stegeer is a psychologist and the author of Flashback Girl, Lessons on Resilience from a Burn Survivor. Like many other psychologists, when she works with clients, Lise often suggests gratitude journals, writing down little things that made you happy that day.
You know, you don't have to write an essay on it, but a little bit. And, you know, some, I tell people, you know, sometimes all you'll be grateful for that day is that it's over, you know. but that's okay. You can be grateful for that, you know, because tomorrow is a new day, and that actually is something to be grateful for.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about happiness, what it means, and how we find it. To some extent, how we think about happiness depends on where we live and how we grew up. Jeannie Tsai studies how cultural ideas shape our emotions. She got interested in that when she first started college.
And what struck me was that so many of the things I was learning in my psychology classes didn't really explain my own experiences growing up as a child of Taiwanese immigrants. And even when it was very rare, but even when they talked about being East Asian, I thought they got that wrong. They talked about East Asians as being really stoic and inscrutable. And my own experiences were that Taiwanese were very emotional. So that is what really made me very interested in really understanding from an empirical perspective how culture influences how we feel.
Jeannie is at Stanford University, where she directs the Culture and Emotion Lab.
We often ask people about a variety of different positive and negative emotions, and also emotions that vary in terms of how arousing they are. So we don't just ask about happiness. We ask about excitement and enthusiasm, as well as calm and peacefulness, more negative emotions like sadness and loneliness, as well as nervousness and fearfulness. And what we've been really interested in is the emotions of these emotions, how much people feel them, and then how much they ideally want to feel them. And we find that across cultures, everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to feel good more than they want to feel bad. But what differs across cultures is really what specific good feelings people want to have. So that in many Western cultures, like the United States, people want to feel excited and enthusiastic and elated more than people in East Asian cultures, where they really want to feel more calm and peaceful and serene. And so when we ask people just to identify what emotions they think of as core to being happy, we find these cultural differences along these lines. European Americans are more likely to say that happiness for them, feeling good, being well, involves these excited emotions, excitement, enthusiasm, elation. Whereas Hong Kong Chinese are more likely to say that happiness for them involves calm and peacefulness and serenity, that those are the states that are core to happiness. And so what we're really finding is that how people define happiness depends on what emotions they value. And this is part of a larger literature that just shows that the meaning of happiness depends on what a culture values.
And as you were talking, I was thinking of pictures, or if I had to choose an image that expresses happiness. And if I think about the American concept of happiness, the picture would sort of be like loud and sort of this exudes a lot of just joy and
exactly.
big
toothy. We call the excited smile the big toothy broad, the Julia Roberts smile. That is American, the sign of American happiness.
I love that up here.
Pretty woman walking down the street, pretty woman.
Jeannie says these images can become a bit of a feedback loop. This is what happiness looks like, so it must feel like excitement, big, over-the-top joy.
Exactly. I mean, after characterizing these differences, we became really interested in trying to understand how we learn to want to feel a certain way. How is it that in the United States, we learn that happiness is this excited form? And how is it that East Asians learn that happiness is really more of this calm form? And so we decided to look at different forms of media in the United States and in different East Asian cultures. We looked at children's best-selling children's storybooks, and we looked at the emotional content of those storybooks and found that the characters in the U.S. children's storybooks showed more open, toothy, excited smiles, whereas the characters in the best-selling storybooks in Taiwan showed more of these calm smiles. And we've looked at, you know, the ads in women's magazines in the United States and China, and we found the same difference. A few years ago, we even looked at the official website photos of leaders in the United States and in China, and we found that U.S. leaders are over 6 times more likely to show these open, toothy smiles than their Chinese counterparts. And it doesn't matter what type of leadership you look at in government, in business, in academia, U.S. leaders show more of these excited, toothy smiles. So the idea is that advertisers and illustrators and publicists are choosing images that reflect the culture's ideal. And then we as consumers of that media, without even being aware of it, internalize those ideals and define happiness in those ways.
And I guess it also becomes a bit of a performance, you know, where if you go into a meeting and you're greeting people and then you're making yourself, I'm making the smile right now. I wish you could see it.
I can hear it.
But it's like, you go in, you're like, hi. And then when people ask you how you're doing, you're like, oh, great. Or you say, oh, I'm busy or, you know, but it's great. So there is also this performance where we perform happiness, because when we don't, then people are like, oh, that person is like so serious or such a downer, or I don't know what.
What's wrong with that person? Or you might notice, like my former German student noticed that people just didn't even approach her anymore because she wasn't showing the excitement that they wanted to see. But I think as an immigrant, you feel that it's a performance. And a lot of people have talked to me about how exhausting it is being in the United States because you have to smile all the time if they're coming from another culture. But I think culture is one of those things that you're not even aware of it a lot of the time. So I think if you're raised in the culture, you just do it. That is the way that you greet somebody. And it doesn't feel like it's a performative act necessarily. It's just the way you think you should be greeting other people. And that happens to me too. I can be having a really serious conversation with somebody and then somebody will bike by. And even if I've been talking about how sad or angry I am, I'll have that big, broad, toothy smile. And genuinely, because I'm happy to see that person. So it can be performative. It can feel performative, but I think it can also just feel very automatic.
Do you think the way our culture portrays happiness and maybe talks about happiness, it sets a pretty high bar for what it means to be happy?
Yes. I mean, I think that oftentimes what can happen is you can become kind of narrow in your view of happiness. When we ask our participants about the most excited event in their life or things that made them excited, they often talk about things that are pretty rare and take a long time to achieve, like winning a national competition or, you know, going on a date with somebody that they've been thinking about for a really long time. But when we ask them about, you know, things that made them feel calm, they typically say things that are a little bit more mundane and easier to achieve, like going on a walk or reading a book. So I think that what's important is to be able to be flexible and open in your definitions of happiness. And sometimes it's hard to do that when you're only exposed to one culture, because culture is telling you about one form of happiness and there's a dominant form of happiness. But that's what we can learn from other cultures, that there are other forms of happiness. And maybe the best thing to do is to have diverse forms of happiness. In the same way you need to have a diverse financial portfolio, maybe it's good to have a diverse happiness portfolio.
And it seems like if you're talking about diverse states of happiness, sometimes it feels like we tend to chase the big happiness. So we're chasing something that's always one step ahead of us, whether it's like the new job or a new house or a new partner or the 20 pounds of weight that, you know, somebody wants to lose. That's sort of like the goal that we should arrive at, and then we will feel happiness. But there's also the happiness that can be felt in this very moment if we focus on it.
Oh, exactly. You know, this is work actually by Brian Knutson and others that shows that sometimes people erroneously think about happiness as the outcome, but there's a lot of happiness in the process or in the journey. And in fact, when it comes to excitement, people feel the most excitement when they're anticipating something, when they're planning for an event, rather than right after the event actually occurs. So happiness can be unpredictable, and oftentimes we're thinking that happiness happens at one time point, when actually it can happen all along the way.
What do you make of the role of social media? It just seems like those messages of over-the-top joy and excitement are just so much more amplified now, because we're seeing not just people in commercials and on book covers. All of our friends seem to be having this exceptionally amazing time, too.
Exactly. And I just think that sets people up for huge disappointment. I've heard that from my students, too. You know, you take a picture of peak excitement, and so people only see that. They don't know what happened before or what happened afterwards. It sets up the expectation that once you achieve something, then you're just going to have that excitement forever. But again, life isn't like that. The problem is that you're not prepared then for what life is really like, which is a lot of ups and downs, but that you can find the beauty in that.
That's Jeannie Tsai. She is a psychologist at Stanford University and directs the Culture and Emotion Lab. Jeannie was just talking about social media, and these days, social media is filled with influencers trying to make a living by selling us a slice of their happiness. It's usually a carefully curated slideshow of staged moments with just the right backdrop and great hair, made to look like snapshots, performance joy rather than authentic feelings. But for one influencer, selling happiness did help her find her own. Reporter Aria Bracci has the story.
Candace Molitor joined Instagram in 2013. She's a photographer in Portland, Oregon. For years, her feed showed a happy mix of concerts, coffee shops, and plants.
I feel like when you go to my feed, it's very light and bright and airy.
She documented the places she visited, the people she met, but hardly ever posted a picture of herself. Then one day, her birthday, she decided to change that.
It really wasn't until 2017 that I had shared a photo of myself on my feed in a swimsuit, and I was super nervous about it. Sometimes with the internet, especially being like a fat Black woman, you just never know.
But the responses were positive, and the post got way more likes than her other pictures.
So I eventually started transitioning my feed to be a little less about my photography projects and a little more about me and my story. I grew up a fat Black girl in a really white town in Oregon and didn't have as much of a community, I feel like, going through school. You know, kids would come in the parking lot waving Confederate flags and trying to be the bigger person, moving past it, almost in some ways being told that your experience is invalid. You know, it gets to you. That's one of the reasons why I kind of turned to the internet and turned to Instagram, was to build community.
And she realized to build that community, she had to be authentic and share her own story, not just pictures of coffee shops.
And that's really when the community started to grow.
Candace got more and more popular on Instagram and eventually started to get paid for posts that promoted products. She's worked with brands like Adidas and Bob's Red Mill.
The vibe overall that I try to give is something that's very positive and approachable. You know, the color palette tends to stay around like a little bit neutral.
Part of Candace's appeal is her happy aesthetic. In her pictures, she might be laughing on a beach or dancing in a field of sunflowers. This is what clients and followers have come to expect. But it's sometimes in contrast with her experiences, with her story.
I felt like I didn't fit in. I was adopted into an all-white family. I didn't feel like I looked like the average Instagram girl. I didn't feel like my life was like glamorous.
But she realized there were other people like her out there.
And I think one of the biggest shifts for me happened when I like stopped following the Kardashians and started following like, you know, body positive women of color and influencers who like shared their journey like similarly to how I share mine.
And now Candace is one of those role models for the people who follow her. For Candace, the allure of being an influencer goes beyond the money she might make from a partnership.
Sometimes it's just that like I really feel like my audience would like this and want to know about it.
You guys, I just finished like my 10th spin class and I feel so good. I have gotten a couple of questions about classified.
From the influencer standpoint, yes, I'm able to share cool things and partner with companies and create income for myself that way. But I mean, there's so much more to the relationship. People come to me, you know, maybe they're having issues with their partner and they really just need a recommendation on date nights.
And she's come to realize her influence isn't just over which products people buy. It's over how people feel about themselves.
Girls who haven't felt comfortable showing their legs in a skirt saw a photo of me wearing a skirt and felt empowered to put one on themselves.
When Candace first started posting pictures of herself, she felt like she was taking a risk. But only 7 months later, she was posting about her struggles with weight and fitness. Candace figured out a way to be authentic and create an atmosphere that's calm and light.
Even if the imagery is beautiful, the caption could be talking about a day where I didn't feel very beautiful. And those are all things that I kind of share with my community on Instagram. I talk about all things, but I especially am talking about, you know, what it feels like to be a Black woman living in Portland, especially right now.
Right now is the summer of 2020, when Black Lives Matter protests started, continued, and didn't stop. They played out right in her backyard in Portland.
You know, I've talked about race and racism on my platform, obviously being a Black woman in Oregon. But when everything sort of compounded online, I really wasn't sure what the reaction from my community and from my peers was going to be. But for the most part, I was really blown away by the amount of support, people who reached out and just wanted to know that I was getting rest, just showing care. I see you. I understand that I will never understand. Sorry, I get emotional talking about it. Being Black in America and in a predominantly white city just doesn't always feel like a safe space. And, you know, I like to think that I carved out a safe space online. I get so much joy from just showing up there every day and being able to connect with my community. I feel like the internet can be an extremely good place to find community and to find happiness.
That story was reported by Aria Bracci.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive. And the world, I'm turning inside out.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. We made a playlist for this episode, Make You Happy, and you can find it on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.